So, man, I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a new documentary coming out about mobile homes.
No, I've missed that one.
Yeah, I just saw the trailer for it.
Man, how did I walk right into that?
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales.
All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
Well, I guess I'm doing okay. Since I talked to you on face to face last time, things have been kind of hectic.
Mm.
But it always settles down when I get up here. It's like I can shut out the world.
Yeah, right.
Talk about things that we really dig. So.
Yep. Yeah. That, like we've said before, this is kind of like our safe zone.
Yeah, we can fortress of solitude.
There you go.
When the on-air sign is shining, don't come a knocking.
Yep, everybody leaves us alone when we flip that on. So, real quick, we want to say go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales. You can sign up to become a patron. We've got three different levels of patronage there that you can sign up for. All levels get a bonus episode a week. It's like a shorter version of Graveyard Tales, where we talk about similar topics to Graveyard Tales. It just might not have enough information to make a full episode, or it is a continuation of a main episode where we're like, hey, this ties in and it would be really good as a Patreon episode. So we put it on Patreon for you guys. So any level gets that. Then our 5 and 10, they also get the ad-free audio and video versions of our main episodes. So if you don't want to hear an ad, you can sign up, be a $5 or $10 member and get ad-free versions of that. And then our 10, on top of everything, our $10, they get our second show, Side Quest, which is like just a total departure from what Matt and I normally do. You get to see me and Matt in a different light. It's kind of like hanging out with us. We're telling each other stories. We're talking about vacations that we had, or, you know, giving you kind of a deeper dive into us. We're playing games. Matt likes to play trivia games with me and see how little I actually know about life. and it's fun over there. We have eaten some bad tasting jelly beans. We have drank some weird sodas. It's a catch all. So yeah. If you like me and Matt, you want to see us in a different light, go over there, become a $10 patron and start listening to Side Quest. And if you're a $10 patron and you listen to our Side Quest episodes, let everybody know that how much you enjoy them. If you hate them, don't say anything. We don't want to hear that negativity.
Yeah, we don't want to know.
Yeah, I'm not into the negativity, but, let us know if you enjoy them. Also, if you want to help us out, you can check out our sponsors. When we have a sponsor on the episode, we will put it in our show notes. You can click the link, go over and check them out, use our code, get you some discounts on stuff, and it lets them know you heard about them from us, so they'll come back and sponsor another episode. So, Matt, that's all the housekeeping I got. So why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
All right. So we're going to talk about a place that, you know, it's one of the most beautiful places on earth. It's peaceful. It's iconic. It's symmetrical in a way that, I mean, it would make your geometry teacher cry.
Right.
I mean, it looks like that when God said, make a mountain, this was the mountain that all mountains were based on. Okay. But beneath that postcard image, things get a little weird. okay? And they get really weird. Because around this particular mountain, it's not just beautiful lakes and scenic forests and hiking trails. You get UFO sightings. You get wrinkled up fanged aliens. You get lake monsters. You get mythological beings. You get haunted forests and magnetic anomalies. And a surprising number of things that make you go, nah, I think I'll just stay in the hotel.
You know? Right.
Today, tonight, we are taking a deep dive into the strange occurrences around Mount Fuji.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Everything from documented sightings to folklore to things that fall somewhere in between. Okay? And, I mean, I had known about the UFO stuff for a long time. You know, I knew about the weirdness that goes on in the forests, but I didn't know the rest of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think I may have surprised Adam with some of the stuff I uncovered. He was like, what? And I was like, trust me, you're going to learn about it.
Yeah. Okay. There's some stuff that Matt found that, I mean, unless you deep dive it like he did, you won't come across it.
Yeah. Unless you're in Japan.
Right. Right.
You know, if you live in Japan, you know, if you live in the Kofu area, you know about this stuff. It's stuff that your grandparents may have shared with you. It's stories that you tell around, you know, a campfire. Mm-hmm. You know, but I mean, I did a deep dive, but I couldn't cover all of it, but I covered some of the most fascinating stuff. So
right, right.
And, but let go ahead.
It may mean that Matt has some Patreons to come after since he couldn't cover all of it.
Yeah. But let's dig into it, Adam. Tell us about the history, the geography, and everything about Mount Fuji.
All right. So as we always say, go check our sources down at the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found all this information, and you can make sure we're telling you the truth about what people have seen and the history and all that. Just go down there, check our sources. If we talk about it, it's sourced and referenced down there. Now, Mount Fuji is Japan's highest mountain at about 12,389 feet. And it's almost perfectly symmetrical, like Matt was saying. It's a stratovolcano. And it's on the main island of Honshu, about 100 kilometers west of Tokyo. It's considered one of Japan's three holy mountains, and it's both a national symbol and a UNESCO World Heritage cultural site because of its religious significance and its enormous influence on Japanese art and literature. Now, Mount Fuji straddles the border of Yamanashi and Shizuoka prefectures, rising near the Pacific coast and dominating the Fuji Hakone Izu National Park. Now, it's so high that on clear days, you can see it from Tokyo and Yokohama, which is 60 to 80 miles away. So, which is crazy to me. You just see this perfectly cone-shaped stratovolcano off in the distance. But geologically, Fuji is a stratovolcano built of layers of lava and ash that formed over several hundred thousand years through the overlapping of three main volcanoes, the Komitake, the Kofuji, or Old Fuji, and the Shinfuji, the New Fuji. The current graceful cone is largely the product of Shinfuji, which became active roughly within the last 10,000 years or so, and it has continued to erupt intermittently into historical times. So Mount Fuji is classified as an active volcano, though it's currently dormant. Now, I think we've said this before about volcano. I don't care if it's dormant. I don't want to live near it.
This is true. Volcanoes of any type make me a little nervous.
Yep.
You know,
I mean, even Mount St. Helens, Like, that blew, and it's dormant now, but it's still a volcano. It still could blow, and we might not be able to perfectly say when it's going to happen. So I ain't cool with living around an active volcano.
Was Mount St. Helens dormant when it erupted? Yes. Mount St. Helens was considered dormant. Mm-hmm. It erupted last in the 1850s before the one in 1980.
Yeah.
Again, don't trust a dormant volcano.
Right. There should be that could be words of wisdom for something.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Don't trust a dormant volcano.
I'm going to tell my grandkids, don't trust a dormant volcano. Mm-hmm. They're going to be like, granddad's getting weird.
Yeah. Don't explain it. Just leave them with that. And then for years, they can use that for different relatable experiences. They'll just go, well, you know, granddad said, don't trust a dormant volcano. Mm. Oh, that's deep. That's deep.
That's deep. Yeah, let's put it on his tombstone.
Yeah. And the whole time you're going, I was just saying something, man.
It's just, you know, preaching the truth.
Yeah. Well, even though it's currently dormant, its last eruption occurred in like 1707 to 1708. And that eruption lasted around 2 weeks. And it sent ash as far as Edo, which is now Tokyo, and it reshaped part of the mountain's flank and created features like the secondary peak of Hoazan. Forgive my pronunciations if I mess them up. Now, flank eruptions over its history have built more than 100 smaller cones on and around Fuji's slopes, along with over 70 lava tunnels and tree molds in the surrounding lava fields. Now, we had a story last year on our listener stories episode of a listener who went down into a lava tunnel.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy to me.
Yeah.
Stay out of lava tunnels.
You know, and it was hard enough to read just visualizing doing that, but then the experience he had is just more of a why were you there? It's mm-hmm. just more reason to not be there.
Yeah, that's just telling you stop going down lava tunnels.
Yeah.
Now, ongoing monitoring tracks seismic and volcanic activity because of the potential impact that another major eruption could have on the densely populated Kanto region. So, like I was saying, that dormant volcanoes might not be dormant for long.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like I said, Mount Fuji is revered in Japan as a sacred mountain, embodying both divine presence and national identity. Its near-perfect form, isolation, and volcanic power have made it a focus of worship, pilgrimage, and artistic inspiration for centuries. Now, in Shinto, Fuji is seen as a dwelling place of kami, or spirits, especially the goddess Konohana Sakuya Hime, who is closely linked with the mountain, volcanoes, and cherry blossoms. So, I hope I said that close
you
to
did.
Right. But
you did better than I think I would have.
Well, it's a long word, and I can fake short words. I can't fake long words.
If you can pull this off in Scrabble, you win.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
It's only got like 300 letters, so good luck.
Now, the mountain itself is treated as a living sacred being, revered as the embodiment of nature's power to create and destroy. Early worshippers built the Senjin shrines at Fuji's base to appease its eruptions and honor its deity, praying for safety and good harvest. Over time, these shrines, springs, lakes, and lava formations around the mountain came to be seen as a linked sacred landscape. Now, the Buddhist and ascetic traditions are from the 12th century. Mount Fuji became a key training ground for Shugendo, an ascetic tradition blending mountain worship and esoteric Buddhism. Practitioners saw climbing Fuji, enduring hardship and isolation, as a symbolic journey through death and rebirth toward enlightenment. Buddhist interpretations liken Fuji's white summit to the bud of a sacred lotus, with the crater's eight cusps echoing the lotus's eight petals and the noble eightfold path. Ascents and descents were ritualized as a vertical pilgrimage between the human world below and a purifying transcendent realm above. Now, from the 17th century, lay devotional movements called Fujiko organized mass pilgrimages, turning Mount Fuji into a popular focus of everyday faith. Worshippers would travel from across Japan to climb the mountain in groups, seeking purification, blessings, and spiritual renewal. Special oshi, or lodging houses at the foot, hosted pilgrims, providing ritual guidance, talismans, and stories about the mountain's sacred power. Even today, many climbers still treat reaching the summit for sunrise as a spiritual act rather than just an athletic goal. Now, religiously, Mount Fuji embodies a tension between beauty and danger. Its eruptions once inspired fear and ritual appeasement, while its enduring form symbolizes resilience and renewal. Myths and literary tales connect the mountain with immortality and afterlife, casting it as a stairway or portal between worlds. Now, in many interpretations, climbing Fuji is a metaphor for shedding impurities and returning renewed, mirroring the idea of symbolic death on the harsh upper slopes and spiritual rebirth when descending. This dual aspect, creative and destructive, protective and threatening, is central to how its sacred power is understood. But beyond religion, Mount Fuji is a core symbol of Japan itself, representing natural beauty, endurance, and a shared cultural heritage. Its silhouette is used in art, literature, corporate logos, tourism campaigns, you know, everything from pre-modern times through World War II and into the present. Now, for many Japanese people, Fuji's presence anchors a sense of place and belonging. It's often described as being, quote, at the core of people's hearts. It's a quiet but constant reference point in daily life and imagination. UNESCO's designation of Fuji-san, sacred place and source of artistic inspiration, formalizes this dual status as both a religious site and a cultural icon.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the weirdness, and You gotta start at the most weird, okay? And that goes back to 1975 with two kids and one of the strangest UFO encounters ever reported. Okay. This has become known as the Kofu incident. So it's February 1975. Two 7-year-old boys, Masato Kuwano and Katsushiro Yamahata, were roller skating near a vineyard outside the city of Kofu, which is not far from Mount Fuji. It's pretty much considered to be at the base. Now, I'm already a big fan of these kids because when I was 7, I was afraid of my own shadow half the time. And as like Adam and I had talked about before, we thought quicksand was going to be a major life obstacle, you know, and these kids are roller skating at the base of a volcano.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But not only that, they see a UFO and instead of running away, they run after it. I mean, that's bravery.
Yeah.
Or really bad decision making, or a little of both.
A little of both, maybe.
Yeah. So the boys looked up and they saw two glowing orange objects moving through the sky. And they described them as glittering and, quote, frolicking.
Hmm.
They were frolicking orbs.
So that actually paints a vivid picture. When you say frolicking, you picture something very specific.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very wholesome way of describing unidentified flying objects. They were not flying aggressively. They were not invading. They were just frolicking like alien puppies.
Right.
They almost like they were playing. Now, one of the objects suddenly flew away toward Mount Otago. It's Otago or Otago. Like potato, potato.
Mm.
The other began to descend slowly before it landed in a vineyard behind the housing estate. And here's where things go from okay to what's happening. The boy said that the object made a crackling, ticking noise, like a Geiger counter, which is never comforting, and nothing good ever follows the sentence, "It sounded like radiation."
No.
You know, no. It sounds like radiation. Well, don't touch it.
Right.
But again,
get away from it.
Instead of running away, which again, probably would have been what I did, they took off their roller skates and they ran towards the object. But when they got close, they realized it wasn't orange. It was actually silver.
Hmm.
It was disc-shaped, about 15 feet wide and 7 feet tall.
Wow.
And there were strange symbols engraved on the hull. And then a hatch opened and a ladder extended out and something came out.
If they didn't before this point, this is where I would look at them and go, run, Forrest, right, run.
Right. You go from, what is that? To, there's something coming out of it.
Yeah.
Ah!
Okay. Take off.
Nothing that's just completely unalive needs a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the boys described a humanoid being roughly 4 feet tall, with long arms and a reflective uniform. Its skin was dark brown and extremely wrinkled, so wrinkled that its eyes and nose were partially hidden. So imagine,
like a Shar-Pei.
Imagine a prune wearing aluminum foil. That's what they were seeing. Which, that's pretty unsettling too.
For sure.
Yeah. So they said it had 3 metallic fangs. Not teeth, fangs, metal fangs.
That's just,
yeah.
No.
So again, at this point, you've got you got 2 options. You can run, or you can become a part of whatever this alien is wanting to study.
Yep. The metal fang Shar-Pei alien.
Here. That's right. Now, they said the creature walked around the vineyard almost like it was exploring, and then suddenly turned toward them. It walked up to one of them, placed a hand on its shoulder, and patted him twice.
Hmm.
Which, you know, people that have studied this have said this was either a greeting or some type of scan or like the weirdest, most confusing pediatrician appointment. I'm like, what? It just pat, pat. And that was it.
Yeah, that's like, weird.
The boys also said that the creature made a sound like a tape recorder running backwards.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's what I imagine. Mm-hmm. Like when you the backward masking stuff.
Yeah. It's either that or it's just that the sound of like when you hit rewind.
Yeah, maybe. But the boy that was touched said he immediately felt weak, almost paralyzed, and collapsed. But his friend did something incredible. He picked him up, threw him over his shoulder, and ran away.
Oh, wow.
At 7 years old.
Good on you, dude.
I mean, at seven, I probably wouldn't have been able to pick up one of my friends. Now,
yeah, probably not.
If I was pumped full of adrenaline because the metal-fanged prune Shar-Pei thing had made my friend paralyzed, I might could have done it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, no. I mean, that was just – I mean, it's amazing to me that it got to that point before they ran, or right. at least one of them ran. So when they got home and they told their mothers, the mothers did what any rational parent would do. They went to investigate. Because, you know, that's what good parents do. My child saw a radioactive fanged alien. Let's go find it.
Yeah.
But I've got to believe, just like I would believe, that this is a 7-year-old imagination at work.
Yeah, okay? Sure.
So when the parents reached the vineyard, they reportedly saw a pulsating orange light. Then suddenly a flash and the object launched into the sky and was gone. So they didn't really want parents to be involved. But yeah, I don't necessarily think that they were after these children either. I think it was a wrong place, wrong time kind of situation.
Yeah. It seems like if they actually wanted to take the kids, it would have been pretty easy.
Oh, yeah, they wouldn't have had any trouble. If they could paralyze one with a couple of pats, why wouldn't they immediately paralyze the other one if their goal was to take them?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next day, the boys told everyone at school. Of course they did. That's what do. The principal and teachers went to the vineyard. And here's what they reported.
Why do they need to go to the vineyard?
I don't know. Everybody is just intrigued. These boys must have been really
truthful.
Truthful. Yeah. Truthful, had a history of telling the truth, but were also very convincing in their story that they didn't make this up.
Mm-hmm.
So you think, well, let's go see what they saw. But if the parents are backing them up going, yeah, we went and we saw this, we didn't see the weird alien thing, but we saw this. So the principal and the teachers saw two concrete posts that had been knocked over, impressions in the soil, traces of landing gear, and alleged radiation readings. I'm not sure why it says alleged radiation readings. I'm assuming that is because none of them had a Geiger counter in their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Somebody just like licked their finger and held it up and went, oh, yep, there's radiation here.
It's like licking a 9-volt battery.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Oh, yeah, it's still good. But here's the interesting part. The boys were questioned repeatedly by teachers, parents, investigators, UFO researchers, and their story never changed. Not once. Which is unusual.
It's incredible, actually.
And it's unusual because if they were making it up, their story would definitely have changed a little bit. It may have become more embellished.
Yep.
You know,
fantastical.
And they wouldn't have matched for sure. Right. Because honestly, you know, when my kids were that age, you could ask them what they had for lunch and you'd get a dozen different answers.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the government's explanation of what happened. Japanese aviation officials later said that the boys probably saw a YS-11 aircraft. Okay. But that doesn't explain the landing of said aircraft, the creature that got out, the fact that that one boy was paralyzed, the fact that they used a ladder to crawl out of this thing, and last but not least, the metal fangs.
Right. It also, you're saying they probably saw? Well, if it's your aircraft, you would know if there was one in the area.
Sure.
So you would know that they saw this or not. You wouldn't say, well, they might have. We lose track of our YS-11 aircrafts all the time. And they just go willy-nilly all over the place.
And do me a favor. Go look at a YS-11 aircraft.
Okay.
And you tell me if this is remotely like what these boys described. I mean, this thing is an airplane.
Yeah, that doesn't look anything like
it. It is an airplane. It is so much like an airplane that you would go, that's an airplane. If somebody said, draw me a picture of an airplane, they're drawing this.
It even has propellers on it.
I mean, under the dictionary, it would say, oh, yes, this is a picture of an airplane.
Airplane, okay? Yep.
Not a disc, not 15 feet long and 7 feet tall.
Not piloted by Sharpeys with metal fangs.
Plus, it's huge, and there is no way in the world that a plane like that is landing in a vineyard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so when I heard that, I thought, ooh, did Japan have some really cool airplane, you know, in 1975? No, they had a regular-looking airplane.
Yeah, they had an airplane.
So let's move ahead a little bit. Let's jump a few years, and the boys are now teenagers, and they go back to the site. Okay? Now, in 2001... they were hypnotized during a television show. Guess what? Their story remained exactly the same.
Huh.
So 26 years later, under hypnosis, their story was still the same. No changes, no embellishments. Now we're talking about now two adults still describing a wrinkled alien that patted one of them like he was being welcomed to Costco. Okay?
Yeah.
What in the world? I mean,
it certainly would have changed by this time if they were lying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if... Because you and I have looked at strange UFO sightings all over the world. We've never really dug deep into this one.
No.
And this one to me holds up to all of the other major UFO sightings that have happened for the last 60 years.
Yeah.
Or more. I mean, you know, you think about, you know, the Travis Walton incident. You think about the Rendlesham Forest incident, whatever they've decided to call the one in Brazil. All of those. This one is, to me, is just as compelling.
Yeah.
If for no other reason than these kids' stories never changed. So, I mean, honestly, I probably told some zingers when I was 7, 8 years old. There is no way on this planet that I am going to be able to reproduce one of those stories verbatim without any details changing. Look, I couldn't tell you a story that was true from the time I was 7 years old and it not change a little bit.
Right.
I mean, there is no way. So, you know, this one, you know, as far as weirdness around Mount Fuji, this one is, this one takes the cake. But when I came across this next one, I knew, I was like, ooh, Adam's going to love this. The lake monster of Mount Fuji.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if UFOs weren't enough, Mount Fuji also has its own lake monster because apparently Mount Fuji is just determined to win paranormal bingo. We got to have it all, okay? We got to have it all. So at Lake Matsu, or Matsu, which are one of the Fuji Five Lakes, people began reporting these sightings in the 70s, again with the 70s, of a massive creature in the water, and they called it, well, what do you think they called it, Adam? It's in Lake Matsu.
The Matsu monster?
No.
Think messy?
Mossy.
Mossy, okay.
Everything, you know, the Chesapeake, you know, is a Chessie, yeah. You know, it's everything is like a take on Nessie. So this mm-hmm. one is Mossy. And if you're going to be terrified of a monster, you might as well give it a cute name.
Right.
Now, the witnesses of Mossy described a crocodile-like body, multiple humps, it being up to 30 meters long, and it moves silently through the lake. Now, a few people have said they've seen it basking near the shore. Others saw it disappear beneath calm water. And in 1987, someone filmed something. The footage shows a large disturbance and what appears to be a rough textured back. But the film was inconclusive, which is cryptid speak for it could be a monster or a log or waves or a big carp, you know, or an owl. I mean, you know, come on. You know, whenever that inconclusive, it's because it's not wearing a name tag. You know, yeah. I don't get it. But you can go and look up the footage of Mossy from 1987 and I mean, it's not enough to make you go, that right there is a lake monster, but it is enough to make you go, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
What in the world is that? So, yeah, go check it out. I mean, giant crocodile snake hybrid comes to mind, but I don't know. But I think it's kind of cool that during the same decade that had this amazing UFO incident, we also get this bizarre lake monster sighting. So it makes you wonder what in the world was going on in Mount Fuji in the 70s.
Right.
Well, I tell you what, they were, you know, playing some American disco and trying to catch a lake monster and trying mm-hmm. not to be abducted by UFOs is what that was going on.
Right.
Now, this next one is more of an ancient legend. Because Adam said, hey, are there any cool ancient legends? I was like, well, as a matter of fact, because Mount Fuji it has so much history. It's so unique. It's also tied to the legend of a giant that I'm gonna butcher this, but I'm gonna do my best. A giant known as Deidarabachi. And this being was said to be so enormous that he shaped the landscape. Mm-hmm. One story claims that he lifted Mount Fuji in one hand and another mountain in the other to compare them, which
wow.
That's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's, you know, just imagine he's got a mountain in one hand and the other, and he's just kind of like, he's weighing them out. Okay. That's what the legend says. Another legend says that the lakes, the five Fuji lakes, formed from his footprints. Because, you know, if I ever saw a footprint that big, I would probably give up camping.
No joke.
And no this, joke. You know, this lake looks like a big foot. Where'd Matt go?
yeah, right. It's one thing to see like Bigfoot footprints that are like 12 to 16
uh-huh.
inches.
Yeah.
It's another one that's like 1200 feet.
Yep.
You know, whatever.
Yep. Yeah. It's, you know, it is a legend, But, you know, again, this is one of those things that if you lived in Japan, if you lived around Mount Fuji, this is one of the stories that you hear, you know.
Right.
But again, it's just the majesty and the uniqueness of this gigantic dormant volcano that everybody just lives in the shadow of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to bring about some of these legends. Now, let's talk about one aspect of Mount Fuji that Adam and I have discussed in detail years ago, and that is the Sea of Trees, also known as Aokigahara.
Yep.
Now, this is probably one of the most mysterious places in all of Japan. The forest sits at the base of Mount Fuji, and it is famous for its weird, eerie silence. The ground itself is made of ancient lava rock, and the trees, they grow insanely dense. Wind barely moves through there, so the sound is muffled. And it, when you're inside it, it just feels wrong.
Yeah.
It's not like a forest you've ever been into. It's like you've stepped into a place that forgot it's supposed to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
Compasses behave strangely in Aokigahara, and it's so quiet in there that visitors say that you can hear your own heartbeat, you know, which that'd be okay with me because it let me know I was still okay.
True.
Until you start to hear something else. And the Japanese folklore talks of the yurei, which are restless spirits. These are souls that are unable to move on. So in Aokigahara, many believe that these spirits wander among the densely growing trees. Hikers have reported whispering voices, shadow figures, sudden cold spots, flickering lights, feeling like they're being watched, and hearing footsteps when they know they're alone. And everyone that goes there has this description of the forest as feeling heavy or oppressive. Yeah. It's like one person described it as walking through a memory instead of a place. Like,
that's crazy.
You're not supposed to be there. Others claim that they have seen pale figures between the trees, just standing still, but they're gone when you approach them. Now, one of the strangest reports involves glowing orbs that float silently through the woods. They're not bright. It's just this faint light. It's almost like it's trying not to be noticed, which I think that's worse than something trying to be noticed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think so, because you feel like you're seeing something that you shouldn't be seeing.
Exactly. Now, the silence is got to be the most unsettling part. No birds, no insects, just stillness. And some hikers say that the quiet is so intense that your mind begins to feel it. Which makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You start hearing things. You start imagining movement. And you begin to question if you're really alone. But then every once in a while, something moves.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that along with all these stories, Aokigahara got famous as being nicknamed the Suicide Forest. But there's a lot of speculation as, is this a place where people have just chosen to go and end their life? Or is it something that dwells within that pulls people in there and brings about their demise?
Yeah.
I mean, it is creepy as all get out, and it sits right there at the base of the mountain.
Yeah. I was going to say, with all the other weirdness that we've talked about so far at Mount Fuji, the Aokigahara being inhabited by something that pulls people in is not that far afield.
No, it's not. I mean, it would make sense, you know, but again, you know, there's a tie to if you were, if your life did end tragically or too soon, say, you know, by suicide, then the Uri is the result of that, you know, yeah. An unsettled spirit. They can't move on. They're trapped within that forest. And so it is a question of, are the Uri there to pull people in to bring this about? Or are the Uri there because so many people have done this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they the cause or are they the effect? You know, and nobody really knows. But the fact that there have been countless suicides inside that forest is true. I mean, there is no doubt to that. You know, what happens, you know, as far as paranormal activity inside the forest is up for debate, but it is no doubt one of the creepiest places in Japan. Now, the lava rock beneath Aokigahara contains iron, and some people claim that this will interfere with compasses. Electronics also tend to behave strangely, and GPS signals become unreliable, which means if you're in a haunted forest full of ghosts, you also can't navigate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's a design flaw. Okay?
You can't get yourself out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you get trapped in there and you can't find your way out, I mean, there have been a lot of stories of people that have said they have hiked and wandered through Aokigahara for hours and thought, I can never find my way out. And then they realize they come out and they're right there. They're right where they started. And they're like, there's no way.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been hiking for hours. I did not turn around, but yes, I'm right back where I started. I mean, other things that have gone on around Mount Fuji, there's been mysterious lights that have been seen over Mount Fuji. There's strange humming sounds that occur. People have reported shadow figures near hiking trails. There's been other unidentified aerial objects that have occurred over the lakes. There's been people hearing their voices, hearing voices calling their names, footprints appearing and then vanishing.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's just nuts. It almost, and Adam, I'd like to get your take on this. Could it be some type of time distortion where you almost go through a time slip? Because people have mentioned that they lose track of time. You know, mm-hmm. they feel like they've been hiking for hours and then realize it's been about 30 minutes. So what happens when you step in there? You know, I just recently did, read some articles on time slips. So this is kind of fresh on my mind. And I definitely think that because of the mountain and then because of the town, you could consider the forest, and not just Aokigahara, because there's other forests right there, as a liminal space.
Yeah, true.
It's a transition. We're going from civilization to the mountain. And you must pass through the forest to some degree in order to reach the other side. So could that be just a giant liminal space where the typical rules that we, feel like govern space and time don't apply right there?
Yeah. And that's very possible. Especially you putting it as a liminal space thing. I didn't think about it that way until you said it.
Yeah.
I don't remember enough about our Aokigahara episode to say time slip for sure, but it does sound like there are portal type things that happen in there where you'll maybe the footsteps and whatever that you're seeing are actually coming from another dimension, whatever it is, somebody walking there and all you're seeing is the footsteps as you walk in, get lost and then come back out, almost like a missing 411 thing, where you know you didn't turn around, but there you are.
Yep.
Back at the start. So it seems like there could be little portals and stuff scattered throughout, or that it's one big one and you just step in. When you step into the forest, you have traversed into another realm that doesn't fit with ours or make sense to us.
Yeah.
And it's very possible time slips could happen in that scenario. Mm-hmm.
But, the question that comes up to me, and it always does when we talk about places like this, like when we talked about Mount Shasta, we talk about the Bridgewater Triangle. Why there?
Mm-hmm.
What is so unique about that spot? And it's interesting because it is a very geologically active region. I mean, you've got volcanic terrain, magnetic rock, deep lakes, and incredibly dense forests. And that's the perfect mix for things like strange lights and odd acoustics and visual illusions. But it's also,
We know the scientists say that volcanoes create volcano lights where there is an electrical charge.
Yeah.
When they erupt. So is there an electrical charge when they're quote dormant, but maybe still active beneath that is charging some of this activity, charging some of the iron, making it a place active, like we say with running water and quartz? Could it be doing the same thing with the magma and the iron and stuff like that?
I think that's a distinct possibility, but all of that combined also creates perfect ingredients for myth.
True.
Because, true. I mean, let's face it, as humans, when a place feels unusual, stories develop.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because we want to explain it away, even if that means the explanation is fantastical or mythical.
Yeah.
You know,
humans don't like having questions.
Exactly. And around Mount Fuji, the stories never stopped, whether it's, two boys meeting a fanged alien or a lake monster that's beneath the water or a giant that actually shaped the mountain or these restless spirits that wander through a forest, Mount Fuji is a lot more than just a mountain. And it is a magnet for mysterious stories, legends, and folklore. And that's why I said, for the people that live in Japan, they know these stories and probably so many more. And the folklore of that surrounds Mount Fuji is fascinating. And there are at least four or five incredible stories that were way too long for me to get into this, into one episode of Graveyard Tales. So, you know, do look, because I'll be doing some Patreons on this Japanese folklore that surrounds Mount Fuji, because some of these stories are incredible. Yeah. But you know, you feel something when you're there. You know, it mm-hmm. it may not be fear, but it's just, you know, that sensation that the world is bigger than we know, and we don't know everything.
Right.
And there might still be something there that's, you know, watching us or frolicking in front of us or, you know, paralyzing 7-year-olds. You don't know, but, you know, it has definitely, you know, produced a lot of really bizarre occurrences. And, you know, I just, you know, I think it's an amazing place. I've never been to Japan, and I've only had one friend that ever went to Japan, and that one friend that went to Japan made me want to go to Japan so bad. I follow a guy, on social media, and all he does is film himself walking around in Japan at night, and I'm like, maybe Japan's where I need to be. So like this place, it's like something out of the future. You know,
we have a podcast friend who he does ghost stories and legends about, Japan, lives in Japan. But I also, when I worked at the guitar shop, we had a factory in Japan, and about once a year they would come over to Tennessee and they would hang out with us and everything. And one of my buddies that, his last name was actually Fukushima, which was interesting to me, but, he would bring me snacks all the time from Japan, you know, candy and stuff like that. And he brought me a Japanese beer one time. Don't know how he got it over here, but he brought me a beer. Actually pretty good. Reminded me of Budweiser, but he would bring these little dried snacks, and it's kind of like a trail mix. And I realized after eating it, there was dried shrimp in it.
Oh yeah,
tiny little dried shrimp. And I was eating it, and I went, that's dried shrimp. Oh well, and just kept eating it. It was actually pretty good.
I think we had a couple of things on that side quest that we tried that were from Japan, and
They
were pretty good.
I can't remember. Yeah.
So
Japan knows how to do food.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Michael wants to go to Japan. And I said, if we go to Japan at any point, we're doing a food tour of Japan. I don't care what else we do. I'm just going and eating. I'm going to like Japanese 7-Elevens. I'm going to all this stuff where they got candy and snacks, and I'm doing that because I want more Japanese snacks.
That's right. That's right. And I love the vending machines that are like what you used to see like at the grocery store here. You know, you'd put in a quarter and you'd get like a spider ring or something in a little bubble.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they have these, and I can't ever remember what they're called, but they have them in Japan where you can get like, you know, something actually cool.
Have you seen something that's big,
you know, and actually has some value to it, you know?
Right. Have you seen the mashed potato and gravy vending machines?
No.
I'm pretty certain this is Japan, but you go up and you get a bowl and you stick it under there and it will vend mashed potatoes in there. And then you can either do it with or without gravy. And it'll do brown gravy on your hot mashed potatoes. And I'm like, that is amazing for me.
Yeah.
I love mashed potatoes and gravy. And I even like brown gravy. I know I'm Southern and white gravy is really all we got, but I like brown gravy too.
Look, gravy is gravy and it's fantastic.
Right? So if we could If we could bring anything over here, I would say mashed potato vending machines, yep. please.
So if you can't tell, Graveyard Tales, we're all about Japan. Okay.
Yeah, right.
We need to have a Graveyard Tales tour of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We're on board. So if you can help us out in that respect, give us a holler.
Food and ghosts, please.
Oh man. So, but what do you guys think? Okay. You've heard all these weird stories about Mount Fuji. What do you think? You think there's really some legitimacy to some of these? I mean, the UFO sighting, you know, the lake monster, the strange forests, you know, let us know. And the best place to do that is in our Facebook group. It's called The Graveyard. We've got thousands of people in there every day sharing unique stories, asking questions, telling jokes. It's a good, safe place. Nobody's going to call you some wacko. We all just want to hear these really, really cool stories.
They just call me and Matt wackos. They leave y'all out of it.
We're the king of the wackos. But don't forget to check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. And there you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can listen to the show and you can become a patron. And thank you to everyone who supports the work that Adam and I do. I mean, we could not keep doing this show for all these years without your support. So we appreciate it and we thank you. So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.